Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
I knew it was over. I felt punishment was coming, you know. I looked at the picture, I said, geez, you know, look at that guy. He deserves to get caught, you know. When are they going to catch him, you know? The more I saw all that, the more I wanted to get caught once and for all.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Bill and Jack in conversation. Bonus episode 4. Jack's interview notes. All right, what are we looking at here, Jack?
What are we looking at? Handwritten notes sketched in haste 41 years ago in 1980 when I was interviewing the Son of Sam, also known as David Berkowitz. And I'm trying to make sense of notes that are more than four decades old and have been brain cells layered over with a whole lot of other murderers and madness and mayhem. And
so these notes were written for what purpose?
To refresh my memory as I went through the interviews I was taping and to write newspaper articles and a planned book on the inner workings of a madman's darkest recesses of his mind.
And this was something you were trained to do as a reporter, I would imagine. Notes used to be a much more important part of the process than they are now that we have so much readable recording equipment.
Right. I had very primitive, probably from the 1950s era, old German, that was called a portable recorder, but it was about 18 inches wide and 6 or 7 inches deep, and it weighed probably 20 pounds. And I had to, it was a 220 volt, so I'd have a transducer, a voltage.
Oh, because it was set up for Europe.
Yeah. And it had a handheld microphone, and it was on unidirectional. The brand was a Ewer, U-H-E-R, which was an amazing piece of equipment, just the fact that the tape recordings I did 41 years ago were still listenable and transcribable as recently as last year.
And so that's the machine that you used to record the 9 reels that ended in the 19-hour interview that are the center of the podcast.
Exactly.
Excellent. So walk us through some of these notes here.
Okay, some of the notes, I apologize for not putting dates on things, but that's the way, unfortunately, I roll. Must be something. He said, just this, they were terrible crimes and they're over with. Murder is cruel, nothing ingenious like Sherlock Holmes stories. He's talking about a book that another person was working on that he found exploitive of the murders. McGraw-Hill wants to exploit, not interested in the good points. And according to him, the good points are the fact that he now has become an honest human being and interested in helping the victims of all crime, violence, and desecrating the graves of the dead, exploiting the sick and morbid aspects.
So this is more condemnation of Klausner.
Right. He's condemning the whole publishing and movie industry in the terms that most people would use to condemn people who do the sort of wanton murder that he committed.
It does speak to this idea that he feels that he can erase these crimes with something good. Like he's saying they don't want to pay attention to the good. They only want to pay attention to the bad.
Right.
Which is kind of shows that he feels that it's possible to reverse the scale, which I think is inaccurate.
Right. Right. And one thing he and I agreed on was that it's important to probe the minds of people like him to learn as much as we can. But probing those minds involves returning them to the scene of those awful acts and making them look at it again and think about it again and try to maybe gain some shareable insight as to why they could do that even once, but certainly more than once. If it's such a horrifying act and you acknowledge that it's a horrifying thing that you did.
In some ways, it feels like he almost wants to have his cake and eat it too, in a way, where he can have the fame, have the notoriety, have the attention, have the microphone, so to speak, and the platform, and leave the murders out.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very, very selective, and because that's what he's become comfortable with, everyone else should be comfortable with that too. And that's why, as you noted in, or as we noted in one of the letters, you know, he was questioning why I wanted to make him talk about the,
as if there's any other reason to be speaking to him at all.
Right, because we just gloss over everything else, and suddenly his main function and role in life and what God created him for was to become the ultimate spokesman for crime victims, of which he created more than his share.
Right. Wow. So what else you got in here, Jack?
He says, all right, I'm the culprit. I'm the evil one. People alive are still going to have to suffer. Movies cause them to suffer again. Guilt, shame, and embarrassment.
So this is in reference to the victims having to rehash the crimes because of the coverage on the crimes.
Right, because, you know, remembering them and trying to sort them out in some way to make sense out of them is to inflict as great or greater pain than the crimes themselves.
Which certainly has some truth to it, in some ways.
In some ways, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but there are two very different ways of dealing with that. I mean, if you are reliving an event to try to understand it and come to grips with it and perhaps prevent others from doing the same thing, that's a positive and creative way in reason. But to refuse to talk about it, particularly when you're the murderer, to refuse to talk about it in a way that can maybe help bring closure to victims' families, because, you know, God, you know, we all look for reason in shooting some innocent young person that you don't know, and have accept that, you know, fate put you in the same place at the same time. How does the family ever come to grips with that? The daughter who was so promising, who was all studying for college, and, you know, and some madman walks up and sticks a gun in her face and blows her brains out, you know. But that was all in the past, so now he just wants to talk about dad, and maybe at this point in his life that he's back on good graces with God, you know, talk about what Jesus has done for him.
Convenient.
Mm-hmm.
Still calling the shots.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Staying in control and, you know, and trying to keep the spotlight on himself, although this time in a more positive way. And, okay, here's something he said, that his redemption should prove to the public in general that people in prison are salvageable. So there's the, you know, we get into the issue of prisoner rights, too, and he became, attempted to become a big champion of the survivors of the awful Attica riots that happened at Attica Prison 9 years before he arrived. 10 years before, no.
But again, it's not getting out of the power seat. Now he's providing a service.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It was similar with Mark, too, right? Mark David Chapman, murderer of John Lennon. It was like, you know, the spotlight is on me because of this act, and then afterwards it gets to stay on me because I can let you know how God can work to save people, and I can be the key to this information.
In spades, in Chapman's case, I mean, right. That is a huge part of the reason that he murdered John Lennon, and, you know, and knowing at the time that it was wrong, that it was evil, and trying to, you know, put some veneer on it, that John was a phony.
Right.
And he was going to expose John to the world. You know.
Berkowitz has a flavor of it. Chapman had it maybe even a bit more, but mm-hmm. similar kind mm-hmm. of thought pattern.
And ultimately, I mean, maybe not all of these guys, but 99% of these guys, you know, want to be caught. What they're doing is much or more of a mystery to them than to anyone else. And the only way that they have a chance of ever having their story listened to in a meaningful way is by doing these horrible things. And suddenly, at that time in particular, I mean, media were all over them. They became, I mean, real anti-heroes on, you know, on a major stage.
Well, you don't get famous without getting caught, and you don't get to go into a deep psycho analyzing kind of situation without getting caught. Suddenly you have all of this press at your disposal, and you also have all of these doctors and attention and this like round the clock staff to help you unravel something that you don't understand.
Yeah. And something I think we touched on previously is that the worst thing for maybe not all humans, but for most of us, we, you know, we want to be known for something, at least in our own family or circle of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're a total outsider and you're just a loser and you know it, you're a nobody, like, you know, Chapman confronting his nobodiness and,
mm-hmm.
and juxtaposing that against, you know, John Lennon, who had been his childhood hero and was the biggest hero in the world. And maybe to an extent, Berkowitz was doing that with all women. His adoptive mother, you know, almost too good to be true, this sort of really angelic person who just wanted the best for him. He always sensed that there was something different about him. And he had been told that, you know, at an early age he was adopted, which in his case might have not been a good thing. And he carried that brand of being something different. And then when he ultimately did find his birth mother, she wasn't this wonderful woman that he was told she was, who had died giving birth to him, and his father was not this crushed and broken man who had loved this wonderful woman so much that he couldn't bear being reminded of her by keeping the child, David Berkowitz, you know, little.
It wasn't fantasy. It was more reality, and reality was what he couldn't deal with from the beginning.
Yes.
Is that the connection between him and real life and confronting real life and having problems and overcoming them and dealing with other people and overcoming the issues that arise from having real people in your life was something that he was backing away with from consistently and constantly and failing at, and the chasm just getting wider and wider and wider. Right.
Right. He realized that there was something totally inauthentic about his entire being here. You know, he should have, in a later day, probably today, he would have, you know, he would have been immediately aborted as a fetus. And it's too bad that option was not available then.
So what else you got here?
Yeah, he goes on and on about exploitation. Okay, here we're talking about strong motivating factors were movie chaos. 75-76, the Texas Tower movies that he saw. Taxi Driver. It gave me encouragement. One of the strongest motivating factors in my life. A tremendous negative influence on me. He mentions the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which of course was pretty much a total fantasy. Yeah,
he doesn't mention that in the interview. Are these notes from before the interview takes place?
Could very well be.
Yeah,
could very well be. And he says here, I can't understand a guy like Truman Capote. So he had obviously, you know, this was an allusion to In Cold Blood, obviously.
What does that mean? I can't understand a guy like Truman Capote.
I think he's talking about somebody who would recreate a crime in the vivid detail that Capote did for the book In Cold Blood and the later movie.
Which is commonly known as the first, sort of the grandfather of true crime, right? In Cold Blood. It's the first kind of factual, historical fiction kind of crime book, right?
Yeah, and it's arguably one of the few examples of true crime literature as opposed to true crime sensationalist kind of, you know.
Because of its devotion to documenting the humanity in such detail.
Right, and he resents that. He thinks it's a bad thing.
That kind of heralds back to this prudish thing, right? He doesn't want to talk about murder. He doesn't want to talk about sex. He objects to that book because they discuss the act. Is that what your idea was?
Yeah. He's talking too about the Yorkshire Ripper. I'm sure that will be a movie. Jack the Ripper, a book, mentioned many others who pattern themselves after, you know.
The Yorkshire Ripper movie just came out, I think, last year.
Oh, okay. So he was prescient. Yeah. and he definitely said that at the time that the murders were going on and they were being reported in the news, he was definitely being encouraged by the Daily News and the New York Post. Which definitely did sensationalize and exploit the murders. I mean,
because sort it was of, driving sales in an unprecedented way.
Yeah, they were selling a million copies a day at one point, I think.
I know they hit some circulation highs during that time period.
Yeah. If a subconscious guilt would come to my mind, I'd read these papers, and they seem to be telling me, go on out there, do another one.
Wow.
I'm not attempting to push off responsibility for what I did, but repeatedly saying, he mentions Albert Speer, Spandau, our common bond, we're both in protective custody. Speer was still alive at that time, Hitler's one of his henchmen.
Can you tell us who Speer is?
Speer was, I guess, one of the arguably more sane Nazis. I think he was he began as Hitler's architect, and he wrote a very revealing biography of the whole Nazi era while he was imprisoned.
And what's the commonality that Berkowitz is expressing?
That they're both in protective custody. Mm. That was in his mind at that time. Some sort of moral reckoning of what lay behind it all.
Oh, I see. Because they're both explaining an atrocity.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. But then again, this is a grandiose self-assessment.
Yeah. And I mean, here he's saying outright, I feel I can do good too, if they will only listen to me. And by listening to him, that means listen to me preach about what a great guy I could be, about helping crime victims without talking about the crimes.
And when he says voice, when he references voices here, he's talking about an inner voice, not a demonic voice of a demon. He's talking about an inner voice like we all hear.
Right.
Don't typically tell us things like this.
Yeah. See, public has two views. I'm either a raving madman or a cold-blooded fiend. And he says, I'm just not going to be silenced. I do owe society something. I have a cause to help the victims of violent crimes. Civil laws, not criminal laws, need to be enacted.
Now, because this material is not in the audio tapes, this is probably from interviews that you conducted with him, sans recorder, in 79?
Probably. And he goes back to the entertainment industry is villainous. It contributes to the rising crime rate. Victims suffer so that money can be made for companies. And he says that his objective is to deter others from repeating my acts and harming others. And he's back on McGraw-Hill. Remember, my father threw him out of the house. He's a liar. He's vulgar. This is Klausner. Klausner apparently attempted to try to interview Nate Berkowitz.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nat and Pearl Berkowitz. Encourage me to work even harder because my life may be shorter than I think it is. You're right, yeah, and he's referring to his throat slashing here.
Okay.
So
that puts it in 79.
Yep. It was really a close brush with death. If an inch closer, I wouldn't be here now. It was true. The shank caught him. The guy just missed his jugular. I joined the Army because I was patriotic. I wanted to go to Vietnam. 1971, I was ready for Nam. The last minute, the war was winding down. Went to Korea instead. First of the 17th Mechanized Infantry. So, yeah, he would have stood watch there if he'd...
What was going through your mind when he was saying that as a veteran yourself participating in the early part of the Vietnam conflict?
Well, I wasn't so crazy that I wanted to be a frontline soldier. You know, I was very happy when I was assigned school and the kind of duty that put me mainly at the periphery of that war, that I only came under fire a couple of times. And that was when we were in the air over North Vietnam. There are a lot of people I know who want to go and carry a gun for imagined glory. I think very few do it for what we call patriotic reasons. I mean, nobody in their right mind wants to kill or be killed. But we're talking about about a guy here who clearly did, and other men that I interviewed inside Attica Prison, who came to admittedly enjoy killing. And after a battle was over, this one guy talked about walking the battlefield with his K-bar, and if anybody was kind of groaning, still alive, or even might be alive, he took his K-bar knife and ripped her throat out. And when he came home, he was on the streets, came from a very broken family, and became homeless, and he and another veteran happened to meet a woman who offered them a meal and invited them in, and made the mistake of asking him what he did in Vietnam, and he told her he was a Marine, and she said, "Oh, the Marines, those guys are a bunch of animals." And before he realized what was happening, he had the little cheese knife in his hand and had ripped her throat out. And he's back in society today and has been for quite some time, doing quite well, I think.
And this is one of the veterans you worked with at Attica when you were working on the series of about incarcerated
right.
vets, the first article series to come out in the United States about this issue.
Right, right.
With the high percentage of Vietnam veterans right. incarcerated at that time.
Right. And that came after some reading I did on the very first work done by this guy, John Wilson, who's a psychologist at Cleveland State University and Baldwin-Wallace College, actually, which I had attended in Ohio near Cleveland, on post-traumatic war trauma. And when I started looking at the prison population, there were, at that time, just a really high number, percentage-wise, of veterans who had wound up in prison.
And it was that work that would lead you to inmate issues, that would lead you, in turn, to Berkowitz, Chapman,
right.
et cetera.
Right. That was that, after my coverage of a prison strike a couple of years after the 1971 prison riot at Attica. The world's attention kind of became focused on Attica for quite some time. It was it became, in a sense, for me anyway, this enclosure, this laboratory for the study of human evil.
Oh, sure.
There these guys were in specimen cages.
How conscious do you think you were of that at that time? Is that something that you realize now, or was that something you realized then?
I think I maybe intuited it then, but I didn't articulate it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I knew that it was important work, and I had always been interested in human psychology, like a lot of people are. But maybe mine, given my background and history and family situation, my predilection was more for the abnormal psychology and violent behavior.
You had something to figure out there. On
yeah.
a personal level, you spent a lot of time there.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe I realized in some sense that, because of some of my own hostilities that I felt inside for the way that I had grown up in disadvantaged situation, that there but for the grace of God go I. And why am I not one of the guys being interviewed here mm-hmm. instead of doing the interviews?
Where is that line? Well, and I mean, Berkowitz talks about it in the interview, is that the line is the action.
Yeah.
That you can think about, you can get cut off. I think he says this specific example about you can get cut off on the freeway and you can think about slamming your car into that person because you're annoyed, or you can do it. And if you do it, you've changed everything about your life because you've crossed this line that you can never uncross,
right?
Where you've hurt someone on yeah. purpose.
Yeah. You made a choice to break bad.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Now he'll be in prison forever.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no, barring some apocalypse that kills off all of society and, prison guards and everything, and he should stumble out one day. Yeah. He has no possibility of parole.
Well, speaking of that, I don't even think he pursues kind of parole. Yeah.
He said very clearly that he never wants to be outside and faced with the pressures of having to make his own life and suddenly live anonymously. And
another point you perhaps agree on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
right, what else we got in there?
We talked here about his being an auxiliary fireman in New York City in 1970, joining the Army after high school, Christopher Columbus High School in the Bronx. So that a pretty ordinary life, nothing spectacular, 18 months at Fort Knox after Korea. Civil service exam. 2.5, 3 years later, he was called for a job at the post office. Worked as a sheet metal security guard, as a security guard in a sheet metal factory, taxi driver.
That sheet metal job, I read in one of the books about him that was a job that his uncle Harold got him.
Right. Yeah, there was a family connection to that.
Yeah, and the interesting thing I thought about that uncle was that this was a very isolated person that was a total loner who used to kind of disappear on long walks and drives, which is something, of course, that Berkowitz then takes up and makes his own later when he's committing the murders.
Right.
It's these long drives. Because the interesting thing about the murders is that there's 9 events, if you include the Michelle Forman stabbing, which I believe everyone should. And then there's 8 shootings after that. So 9 events. And you think about, especially in the post office phase, he's going out almost every night. And he's driving around for hours and hours every night because he can't sleep, because of Glassman's TV, because of the dogs, because of XXX. And there was another neighbor too, an elderly lady that lived, I think, next to him, that he didn't go after. That's an interesting story as well, because he confronted her and she was the only, or he wrote her a letter and she was the only one that confronted him back. And we all know that he's not big on confrontation. And so he dropped it. After that, she confronted him and it was a situation of like, look, I'm old. I can't hear. It was either a daughter or her. Spoke up and directly said, look, this person is old. They can't hear. This is the volume that they listen to. And that's it. Is there something you want to say about it? And in person, it was done. They never heard from him again.
Right.
And it was a letter received that they connected the dots after, of course, it was all public. But can't sleep, out driving. You just think of how many more deaths could have occurred because of nights where he did not, quote, find someone or didn't feel right or whatever reason.
Or it was raining.
Yeah, or it was raining. Yeah, weather played large into these things.
Yeah, you talked about the movie Taxi Driver coming out. At the time, he was working as a taxi driver.
Because of the movie. In the interview, he says that that he comes back from Texas. He buys the gun the day after they watch it in Texas.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
His army buddy asks him to stay. He decides not to. And comes back, rewatches the movie, and gets a job driving a cab.
And he says he hated the job. He said people were nasty. It was very frustrating. I had to drive 10 hours a day in order to make a decent living. The first crime he committed, he said, was while he was a cab driver, a month and a half after starting.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that fits the timeline. And he worked for 3 months as a driver. Then he went to the apprentice sheet metal work. And
then the bulk of the murders occurred while he was at the post office.
Right. Said he went to while the post office. Layoffs were coming up at the sheet metal factory anyway. And it was a surprise notice from the post office February of 77. Yeah, said 4 murders captured in August 77. I look at my past life. I see how screwed up the damn thing was. I want to try to make amends. I want to try to help society. More negative than positive in here, meaning prison, no families. At least if victims were being compensated, it might be partially justifiable.
Did you feel at that time like the guilt was genuine?
The man is a sociopath. and so is Mark Chapman, and so are a lot of the others. That, and I believe that they can learn to feign empathy, but it's something that it's impossible for them. It's probably just as impossible for them to be genuine in feeling remorse or empathy as it is for you or I or a truly caring, empathetic human being to
be this cold.
To work ourselves up and actually go commit a murder anonymously just to see what it feels like.
Right.
I guess there are people who do that. But, you know,
to just work out an inner condition, as in one of the interviews, he refers to it as therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the taking of an innocent life is something that would solve one of his personal problems.
Right. And, you know, and Chapman and he, too, there are a lot of parallels in all these guys. They talk about their emotions, this rage that they can't handle anymore. And the gun is the perfect tool for that because it's loud and it flashes and it explodes out of the barrel of something they can hold in their hand and control.
Right.
You know, maybe it's another kind of rape. I mean, rape being a crime of violence and that, you know, other kind of explosion.
Well, it's funny you should say that because there was a psychologist who said at the time that, you know, the police were asking for a profile and what he offered was Berkowitz is ejaculating every time he pulls the trigger.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. I think we did talk about that. And he, you know, he denied having orgasms when he was shooting his gun. But no doubt there was some excitement and some sense of release that came from doing that.
It's also a punctuated event that is a punctuation of him stepping out of his nice guy facade, of his 9-to-5, you know, if someone needs help, I pull over and help them, of like help an old lady cross the street. I walk people to their car, women that I worked with who are afraid of the Son of Sam, ironically, will walk them to their car to protect them from the Son of Sam. I mean, I always wondered what was going through his head on this. He describes one of the walks as being a 10-minute walk where he's going on a walk with them to their car at 12:30 in the morning when they get off work to protect them from the Son of Sam, who he is.
And yeah, and he was getting, how many cops do we, you know, public servants do we later find have done some pretty rotten things while they were in uniform.
Sure, you know. Sure. So anything more in these notes?
Just about, you know, I mean, touches on everything that's in the...
Sure.
He mentions the Gary Gilmore book, which I thought was really great. Really well done. I'm blocking on the name of it and the author now, but
maybe let's scan through and mention things that aren't in the interview in the main interview, because we did come across a couple things.
Oh yeah, he says regarding the victims of the Attica riot, I feel like I'm the only one trying to help them. The state is doing nothing.
And this is in regard to the monies generated from the film on the riot?
Yeah. And, you know, he has a point there. The state did nothing. I mean, the state was culpable, and the state tried to cover it up. And there was another Pulitzer Prize-winning book that came out a couple of years ago, excellent book, incredibly well-researched, about just how venal the state of New York was in this thing every step of the way, denying liability after ordering those state troopers to go in there and commit those murders and lying about the circumstances under which the prisoners and the guards died. So yeah, this was when he was he said he had an idea that we as a nation celebrate Crime Victims Day.
Ah, Okay.
I don't think that ever went anywhere.
I don't think so.
Would be something positive about Attica, a new law to play up the victims, give some attention to victims for a change. Attica movie, they just... He said he heard about an Elvis Presley day, so why not a...
Oh, so it reminded him of...
Yeah. Mm. So why not a day in remembrance of the victims of violent crimes? Tried writing letters. There are a lot of widows and fatherless children as a result of the Attica riot. Actually, a reporter friend of mine just worked with one of the women whose father was killed in that riot, and they've just written a book about it. It says it's not easy to live with the crimes you commit. And his idea for the Attica victims, he says, was the first time I felt there's been anything worth talking to anybody about. I guess I asked him why. He invited me to the prison to speak. Yeah, if nobody is going to learn anything, then these victims died in vain. You've got to find out what went wrong.
Is that what you starred there?
Yeah.
Because that was sort of the mantle that you were putting on yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was to find out what went wrong.
My anger was out of frustration, not outright hatred. So he's saying that he wasn't a misogynist. He was just a person who was continually rebuffed. And
that distinction is important because it's not his fault. It's like his way of saying it's not his fault.
To him, it's a way of explaining that, and maybe the therapist that his mother had him see when he was a child in some way helped plant that kind of idea that it's okay. Remember where he used a little toy gun to shoot the soldier? Who is that? That's Jeffrey, and he shoots the...
Mm-hmm. You're referring to some play acting that was done between him and his child psychologist in the early 60s when Pearl and Nat had taken him to get some treatment.
And Pearl obviously, recognized that he had, an anger and frustration problem that needed to be addressed.
Right.
And as you were noting earlier, that's pretty forward thinking for the 1960s.
Oh, absolutely. I was very impressed by that, for sure. Yeah.
I was always a misfit, an outcast. Felt like I was on another planet, angry at my own incapabilities. It was all turned outward when he decided to commit the murders. Whitman, angry at himself. Charles Whitman, the Texas Tower.
What does that mean, Whitman angry at himself?
Angry at himself, but it went outward.
Okay, I remember. So the fascination with Whitman, as I remember from the interview, was what you just said, that personal frustrations that he points outward, because basically at the time that he watches that movie, a couple months, I think it's in the fall of 1975, is at the same time when he's finding out that all of the reasons that he'd been using his entire life to hate himself and to point his anger inward, being that he killed his mother in childbirth, and that his biological father was out there somewhere wanting to kill him because of the anguish that he caused him, basing that anguish on the anguish that he saw Pearl go through when Pearl's father died, who they were very close. So he carries this around for 22 years. I killed my mother. I ruined my dad's life. My dad's coming to get me somewhere. And then finding out that none of that is accurate. That it's actually the father that's passed away, who never wanted the child in the first place, and the mother who is living, mm-hmm. who was not dead, did not kill her. And so he speaks quite a lot in the interview about the anger shifting at that moment from inward to outward, and seeing Whitman as a great role model of someone who did mm-hmm. that by shooting all those people in Texas.
And getting a lot of media attention for it.
Right.
Even though Whitman died, he was still, it was...
It's a huge, shocking international headline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he says, I had this guilty thing. I arranged for myself to get caught.
How true do you think that is?
I think he got intentionally careless. I think it became a game, and he was astonished at the incompetence of the police that were supposedly looking for him. And he kept thinking, you know, how far can I push this? You know,
so allowing himself to be connected to the ticket, for instance, at the Moskowitz shooting, right? Yeah.
And, you know, and remember, too, that he also thought of himself as a pseudo public servant, you know, cop or firefighter or whatever.
Not to mention the fact that also during this time period, he's also antagonizing other people, such as Sam Carr, writing letters, throwing Molotov cocktails. His landlords in New Rochelle, writing them letters, throwing Molotov cocktails at them. I think he believed he shot one of their dogs. He also sent a Christmas card to the landlords in New Rochelle from the cars in order to connect them.
Right.
So that they would know about each other.
Yeah.
Not to mention the letters that he wrote to Craig Glassman. So he was, in addition to this on purpose, this allowance that he made for himself to become sloppy and allow the ticket to be connected to the murder, he also was actively antagonizing and connecting the people he was antagonizing to each other so that they could put these things together. Mm-hmm. And the absolute wildest probably part of the story, I think, in terms of catching him, is Sam Carr's daughter being a police dispatcher.
Yeah, that's almost Yonkers. Like the guy shooting the supposedly empty gun out the window that, you know, that Sam Carr's daughter would be the police
dispatcher. It feels you know? like an element written into a screenplay.
Yeah.
Where they call up and they're like, hey, we have some interest in this guy named David Berkowitz. And it's like, David, did you say David Berkowitz?
Let me tell you.
I can tell you something about David. He's been terrorizing my family for months.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was astonishing. And then that Sam Carr's, you know, one son became a suspect, you know, even though he was ruled out nowhere near where this, you know, he couldn't have conceivably been where these murders were going on.
Tragic for both of Sam Carr's sons.
Yeah. One crashed drunk driving and you know, killed himself, and the other either committed suicide or was murdered by a friend at or near the Air Force base where he'd been stationed in Minot, North Dakota, I think.
Minot.
Yeah. Why not? Minot.
Yeah. and then one of the deaths of the sons was something that connected it out or suggested to people that this is how this satanic group idea got involved from what I've come across.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else we got in here?
Let's see, man. He had researched the hell out of movie and book contracts. I mean, he talked about agents' fees and and bidding wars for manuscripts. And then he goes back into, you know, himself having no proper outlet to release his emotions.
You know, something that's interesting and strange to me about this time period in his life is that, you know, when he was on the outside, he was doing very non-demanding intellectually work, mm-hmm. right? You know, he was drawn to jobs that were mechanical in some way. Like he's driving a cop, you know, he's driving a cab, he's working in a post office, doing things like this. And yet here in prison, he's like dealing with lawyers and reviewing contracts. And, you know, it's almost like an elevated kind of position he's found himself in all of a sudden.
He got a promotion.
He got a very strange promotion. Yeah.
Rebels, about in his childhood, he said he was a person with intelligence but unable to control his emotions. Never tried to do his best. He chose to rebel. Malicious mischief constantly. When I was doing it alone, it was for my own satisfaction. Then something is wrong, he realized. But still there was no proper outlet to release all this stuff that was there. You know, apparently from the day he first began being conscious of his own existence.
Well, the interesting part about that to me is that that's all of our personal responsibilities is to find an appropriate outlet for ourselves, not someone else's fault.
Yeah. And he says that if his parents had been successful dealing with that, I probably wouldn't be here now. I didn't think I needed psychiatric help because there was nothing mentally wrong with me.
That's a delineation that's very important to him, mm-hmm. that being an angry person to the point of committing multiple murders is different than having something mentally wrong with you. That logically he's still fine. He's just emotionally problematic.
And he said that other people do it too, but they take the violence out on themselves by drinking and driving. One time he even mentioned smoking. You know, people are subconsciously committing suicide because they know.
So Berkowitz was a non-smoker.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, he did. I mean, none of the usual things. You know, some smoking is a stress reliever for some people.
Sure.
It never was for me. The only time I smoked was when I was drinking, which I think a lot of people do, you know.
Common.
He said he was challenging the odds. He got to a point where he was challenging fate and that society should analyze this. What makes people do that? The problem is serious.
Any more stuff that's not in the interview, in the main body of the interview?
Yeah, you know, he said, I asked him about the death penalty, if New York had a death penalty, if that would deter him. He said, no. He said, I probably would have done the same thing Gilmore did, which was a firing squad, as you might recall. So depressed, the future was so bleak. Yeah, he talks about he's an ordinary guy, you know. Not like ordinary guys. He said, you know, I would enjoy doing a good day's work, take pride. Sometimes he said that the long drives would be enough to dissipate the anger.
Oh, maybe that's why some of the drives didn't result in a killing.
Yeah.
Did you take notes throughout the process, throughout the entire 19-hour interview?
I always kept a notebook open if there was something that struck me that I wanted to go back to. He said he never had auditory or visual hallucinations, in spite of what he said about the Son of Sam stuff earlier.
Sure.
That whole contrived thing. Felt it was what I had to do. Revenge for imagined wrongs.
Thank you for sharing these with us, Jack.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.